Well, hey, I'm James, one of the pastors on staff here at Faith. And today we are right in the middle of a series that we're doing called Heart, Soul, and Mind. And in this series, we are taking a look at what the Bible has to say about our emotional health and emotional wellness. And just as a summary of where we've been, the first week, Pastor Mike showed us that being a Christian does not exclude us from emotional turmoil. That just because we've come to Jesus doesn't mean that all of a sudden, all of our emotional health issues are going to be taken care of. And then last week, Pastor Mike talked about one of the biggest issues that we face with our emotional health, which is anxiety. And this week, we're kind of taking just a little bit of a course turn, and we're talking about an issue that has to do with our emotional health, but at first, maybe we don't think about it that way, and that is the issue of contentment. Now, I got to tell you right off the bat, there are so many ways that the New Testament talks about contentment. The scriptures talk about learning to be content in the midst of suffering. It talks about learning to be content in the midst of poverty and in the midst of wealth and in the midst of hardship. And the truth is that we can't talk about being content in suffering the same way that we're going to talk about being content with more possessions than we could ever imagine. And so today, instead of talking about the whole issue of contentment, we are going to narrow down and just focus on contentment in a world that is obsessed with more. But before we do that, let's take some time and pray together. Lord, thanks for the chance to come together today, to sing your praise, to gather with our fellow Christ followers. We ask this morning that you help us be open to your word, that you help us see your wisdom and how to apply it to our lives, and that you give us a humility and a willingness to question assumptions that we have and views that we hold that don't necessarily align with your ways. And so we ask this in your name. Amen. All right, I got a question for you. How many of you bought something in the last month that you didn't actually need? Yeah, all right. Who's willing to say they bought something in the last week that maybe they didn't need? Anyone? Yeah, a lot of us. Well, if you did, you are in good company, because as humans, we have a natural bent for more. Most of us, in some way, are obsessed with having more and more and more. Maybe for some of you, it's clothes. You've got a closet full of great outfits, but you go to Target and you see that new set of duds and you're like, I just have to have that. It is amazing and I want to wear it at least once. For some of us, maybe it's toys. We just have to have that new TV. You know, maybe you don't have a TV that you like, even though you loved it up until the point you started looking at new TVs on the internet. Or maybe it's that you have a TV in your bedroom and your living room and your dining room, and you just really need one for the kitchen so that you can watch Selling Sunset while you do the dishes, you know. Or maybe you're like me and you love fly fishing and you already have 4 fly rods. Maybe I have 5. Actually, I lied to you. I have 6, but I still want more. We are obsessed with more. It could be cars, money, houses, cats. It could be anything. We just want more and more and more. Just some stats for you. In 2020, the Detroit News published an article, and it said that the average size of a new single-family home constructed in Metro Detroit was 2,611 square feet. Any guesses on the size of a new house in the 1940s? 900 square feet. That means the average house is almost 3 times as big as one that was built in 1940s. Now, what's interesting about this is that family sizes are actually quite a bit smaller today than they were in the 1940s. So what do we need all that space for? Our stuff, yes. We dedicate more square footage to our stuff than previous generations did for their kids. That's something to think about. Now, this is not a new thing. Humans have always been obsessed with more. In fact, my man Plutarch, the first century philosopher, got any Plutarch fans in here? Get up in the morning and you're like, Plutarch, yes! Well, this is what Plutarch had to say. Said the owner of 5 couches, this is what Plutarch looks like, by the way. Maybe, I don't know. If you search Plutarch in Google, that's the face that comes up. Well, he said, the owner of 5 couches goes looking for 10, and the owner of 10 tables buys up as many again. And though he has lands and money and plenty, is not satisfied, but bent on more, losing sleep and never sated with any amount. I love it when ancient quotes are so relevant to our lives today. Anyone said to their spouse or someone else that they love, we don't need any more furniture. Yeah, it's a very relevant quote. But even though this was 2,000 years ago, it reflects an attitude that's still true for us today. We are obsessed with more. Today it might be TVs and iPads rather than couches and tables, but that same underlying desire for more, it is ingrained in who we are. Now, there's a pretty good reason for this. Theologically speaking, humans were created for a relationship with an infinitely amazing and satisfying God. We were given by Him a wonderful place on earth with Him and a wonderful purpose in His creation. But when we turned away from God, our sin fractured that connection to Him, and it broke the relationships that we are supposed to have to His creations and the earth. So what this means is that each of us is built with a craving for something infinite, but because of our sin, we are left trying to fill that craving with things that by their very nature are not infinite. So what that looks like for most of us is an insatiable thirst for more. I have a little illustration here. It's like you have this jar, and imagine this jar, this glass is you. And imagine that these little grains of rice I have are the things that we think we love. Now, the glass says, wow, I'm feeling pretty empty today. So what does it do? It takes just a grain of rice and it says, I wonder if this will satisfy me. And then it says, how am I feeling? Still pretty empty. I wonder if this other grain of rice is going to satisfy me. How am I feeling now? Still pretty empty. Do you guys kind of get the illustration? We have this huge craving for something infinite, and we keep trying to fill it with things that by their very nature don't have the capacity to fill us. Since the fall of humanity, we have had a desire for more. But here's an interesting part of this. Life has never been like it is right now. Because while humans have always had a hunger for more, we have never had the opportunity that we have presently to have more. This is where our discussion of emotional health comes into play. There are 3 factors that are really unique to us as modern Americans that make this insatiable desire a danger to our emotional health. And I'm just going to run through these real quick for you. First, for the most part, we are the richest populace that the world has ever known. Globally speaking, if you own more than 1 pair of shoes and a car, you are like top 10% of wealth in the globe. But more important to that, historically, no nation in the history of the world has ever had a populace with the degree of wealth and buying power that we have. The average citizen today, the amount of buying power that they have would be incomprehensible to even the average citizen 300 years ago. But you have to pair that increase in wealth with our unparalleled access to stuff. Not only do we have more buying power than ever before, but we have the opportunity to buy more things than anyone could have imagined was possible. Did you know you can buy a harness so that you can walk your chicken? FYI, if I ever see any of you walking a chicken, I will take a picture of you. I will send it to the other pastors, and we will pray for you in staff meeting. What about these lightsaber chopsticks? Oh my gosh, you didn't know you needed them until you saw them. Or what about Band-Aids that look like bacon strips? Because what makes boo-boos feel better than dressing them up like deep-fried strips of pork belly? You know, here's my favorite. Finger covers that keep your fingers from getting cheesy when you eat Cheetos. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Everything you could ever imagine is just a drive, a click, or a voice command away. And if you can't afford it, you don't need to, because we have financing and we have credit cards. We have unparalleled access to stuff. Here's the third factor. We live in a world that is designed to make you want more. Targeted advertising, influencers on social media, everywhere that you look, there is something stoking the flames of your desire for more. I stumbled across this quote from Paul Mazur, who was one of the senior partners at Lehman Brothers during the post-World War II economic boom. And he was working with advertising execs on Madison Avenue and politicians in D.C., and they were trying to make the U.S. economy more powerful than any economy that had ever been before it. And this is what he said. He said, "We must shift America from a needs culture to a desires culture. People must be trained to desire, to want new things even before the old have been entirely consumed. We must shape a new mentality. Man's desires must overshadow his needs." Just think about that a little bit. Corporations, the government, and Madison Avenue were literally conspiring to make our nation wealthier by taking advantage of your natural inclinations for more stuff. Our entire nation is built on a hunger for more. Now, here's why I bring all this up. When our desire for more meets a world where there are no limits on how we pursue that desire, it can wreck us. Here are at least four things that happen to us when there are no limits on how we pursue that desire. First, on a really basic note, and somewhat maybe unspiritual, despite what advertisers tell you, more stuff creates more stress. This happens for a variety of reasons. I want you to take, for example, my canoe. In the grand scheme of things, my canoe is not very expensive. I bought it on super duper sale at REI. But now that I have it, I need room in my garage to store it, which creates a little bit of clutter. Every year, it needs some maintenance, whether that's like some repairs it needs, or adding an accessory, or just putting a new coat of polyethylene on the thwarts. And you know what? I can't just have a canoe. I also need a life jacket, I need a paddle, I need a bilge sponge, I need an anchor, I need a rack for the top of my car to carry it around. And all of that stuff costs more money and takes more space. The time and space and financial burden of stuff is always higher than we think. And what's that end up doing? It causes stress. Stress because we spend more money than we intend. Stress because we have to find space to store our stuff. Stress because we have to find time to take care of our things. Now, something else that's becoming more clear with recent psychological studies is actually that stuff takes up space, creates clutter, and clutter actually releases the stress hormone cortisol in our brain and makes us feel more irritable and less satisfied. Isn't that crazy to think about? Just having more stuff in your home makes you more stressed. This is the thing that I actually think causes the most stress. The things that we buy tend to demand time from us. My canoe, it actually calls to me from the garage. It says, James, I've been sitting here for months. I don't know why my canoe sounds like a ghost, but that's what it sounds like. It says, you haven't taken me out in so long, and I'm just sitting here. Which causes tension for me, because I'm often having to choose between things like spending time with my family or spending time with my canoe, mowing the lawn so my neighbors don't hate me, or taking out my canoe. And here's the kicker. When I consistently don't listen to my canoe calling to me from the garage, you know what happens then? I feel guilty because I spent money on something that I'm not using. We just can't win with it, can we? The more stuff we have, the more our stress compounds. Stuff creates stress. And that kind of stress tends to not be good for our emotional well-being. Just in case you're like, yeah, I don't own anything like a canoe, though, here's a simple one for you. Anyone ever opened up their closet, looked at their 75 different outfits, and was like, well, I just can't find anything to wear today? There are so many options that you get stressed out about which one to choose. You know who never felt stressed about what they wanted to wear? The cartoon character Doug. Yeah, you guys know what I'm talking about? Dude only had one outfit. He's like, what am I gonna wear today? Aha! Same thing that I wore yesterday. No stress. Any Doug fans? Anyone know what I'm talking about? Thank you. There's at least four of you in here. The rest of you are like, what the heck is he talking about? Now, I used to be a little bit more of a clothing hog than I am today. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that that was a really common reality. I'd look at my outfits and I would experience stress because I had so many options to choose from. You know, it's counterintuitive because we think the more options, the easier it's going to be. But that's just not the case, because more stuff leads to more stress, and that takes its toll on our well-being. A second way that our insatiable thirst for more can damage our emotional well-being is that it can actually keep us from engaging in things that are truly good for us. I'm going to tell you another terrible story about myself here. The other night, Owen had fallen asleep, and Meredith and I finally had a little bit of time before bed, just the two of us. So we went downstairs, we sat on the couch, we turned on some Netflix, and you know what I did? I got out my phone, and I started looking at what hunting clothes I want to buy for next year's hunting season. Here I am, finally getting an hour or two with my wife where we're not overwhelmed by my six-month-old, and instead of being present, instead of doing something that's actually good for us, I spent time thinking about what stuff I want to buy. So whether it's dreaming about what we want to buy or organizing what we already own or having to deal with this or that issue that's happening with our boat or our vacation house, our stuff often keeps us from being present in relationships and having the time we need for things like contemplation, silence, meditation. Stuff keeps us in engaging in the things that are truly good for us. Now, third is giving into our desire for more actually makes us feel like our life is missing something. When all we think is, oh, I really need this, it makes us feel like our life isn't what it should be. This is really problematic for our emotional well-being. A person can spend their entire life looking for things that are going to make them happy, only to never discover that things don't have the ability to satisfy the ultimate needs that we have. This is something that Solomon noticed when he wrote Ecclesiastes. This is what he wrote. He said, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves. I had other slaves who were born in my house. Excuse me. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Basically, what he's saying, if you could want it, I had it. He said, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. What he's saying is, I went out and got all the stuff I could imagine, and after accumulating it, this is what I desired, or this is what I decided. It's just chasing after the wind. It's meaningless. It can't satisfy you. Here's what Solomon had over us, though. He lived in a world where even with his wealth and power, there were limits on what he could amass. There was no mass production, no goods shipping all over the world, no marketing firms convincing him of needing this product or that, no Amazon planes flying you that chicken harness so you can get it 2 days delivery. There were limits on what he could have. So I think if Solomon were to have written this today, he would have added one more line to the text. Notice this is Pastor James's version, modernized and expanded. It is not biblical at all. But he might have said something like this. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And here's what I added. But there is so much wind to chase that most men will spend their whole lives chasing it only to never recognize the pointlessness of chasing the wind. One of my favorite passages is in Proverbs. It says this. It says, give me neither poverty nor riches, but only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who's the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. We live in a world of too much, and the dangers of too much are real. One more passage. Jesus said, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. We often take this as a passive teaching, like Jesus just being like, hey, just a reminder, possessions won't fulfill you. But that's not what he's saying here. He says, watch out. If you live like possessions will breathe life into you, you're going to find out that they don't. Let me sum all this up. If you feed your insatiable thirst for more, you will end up having a life of continual disappointment. Why? Possessions don't have the ability to give you the life you desire. And if you seek after them, you're going to realize that you've wasted years of your life looking to possessions to provide you what only God can. Fourth thing, the pursuit of more tends to turn our eyes inward and make us more selfish. Who's usually the object of our desire for more? We are. I want these new pants for me. I want this car. I want. Not only does this develop the opposite attitude of what Jesus is trying to get us to adopt, but it just drains our soul because selfishness is not life-giving. Another passage from Proverbs says this. It says, a generous person will prosper, and whoever refreshes others will be refreshed. It's not by getting more that we're refreshed. It's by refreshing others. So why can giving into our thirst for more be damaging to our emotional well-being? Well, one, it causes stress. Two, it keeps us from things that are actually good for us. Three, it makes us feel like our life is missing something. And four, it fuels a selfish attitude. And all of this leaves us feeling drained and disappointed rather than alive. Now I want to pause here, because in any other setting, we would be heralding the benefits of minimalism. Do you guys know what I'm talking about when I say minimalism? The obsession with less? I might hand you like a Marie Kondo book and say, only keep what sparks joy. Or I might give you a Joshua Becker book and tell you that the solution to the emotional weight of more is to live with less. Declutter. Own less. Adopt a Doug-like closet mentality and only own 7 of the same outfits. Here's the problem with that thinking. If the solution to more is simply less, we're actually exchanging one set of emotional stressors for another. Because now instead of obsessing about having more of this or more of that, I'm obsessing about the one exact thing I need to add to my minimalist collection to keep it minimalist
and satisfy my needs. So now, instead of having a Chemex, a French press, a drip coffee machine, and a Nescafe latte machine on my counter, I'm going to obsess about finding that one coffee accessory that I absolutely need to have that'll satisfy me and meet all of my needs, but won't take up too much space. There we go. This is a quote from one of my favorite magazines, Comment Magazine. In it, Sarah Hammersma wrote this about minimalism. She said, "Other aspects of the broader minimalism movement strike me as less inspiring and more concerning. For instance, things are still at the center of this new movement that is reportedly anti-consumerist. It seems to me that minimalists are obsessed with things. This is true whether it's optimally furnishing a tiny house or optimally parenting little ones using just the right toys, introduced at just the right times, and in just the right quantities. It's weirdly specific. Can one be a consumption Pharisee? The answer to our thirst for more cannot just be an obsession with less. Why? Because the broken part of us that makes our thirst for more so destructive will take something like minimalism and make it just as stress-inducing and counterproductive as our insane consumerism is. There has to be a better answer to our obsession with more than just replacing it with less. So let me ask you, what's the answer for our hunger for more?
Jesus.
Yeah, this is when you get to like bust out your Sunday school answer. Jesus is the solution to our desire for more. I want you to check out this passage from Philippians. If you're like, geez, James, when are we going to get to the Bible? It's now. We're finally getting there. The Apostle Paul wrote this. He said, "I have learned in whatever situation I'm to be content. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." Let's look closely at this. First, Paul says, "I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content." First, we got to ask, what does it actually mean to be content? Because for many of us, the only situations we hear content thrown around is like saying, "I guess I'm just going to have to be content with what I got." Like being content's a bad thing, a second-rate thing. We're only content when we don't get what we hope for. That's not what it means for Paul. To Paul, being content is this. Being content is where we live in such a way where unfulfilled desires do not curb our sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. Two notes about this. First, this does not mean that we have to live an ascetic life where we never seek to fulfill our desires. But secondly, it does mean that we are not shackled by our thirst for more, because contentment allows us to say no to things without feeling like we're missing out on life if we don't get them. Contentment is being content is where we live in such a way where unfulfilled desires do not curb our sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. And Paul says, "I've learned that in whatever situation I'm in, to be content." This is huge. He's saying, doesn't matter whether I'm rich, it doesn't matter whether I have access to more than I can imagine, or if I'm poor and I'm deprived of everything, I am to be content in a way where the degree to which my desires are fulfilled does not determine my happiness or satisfaction. He then goes on to say, "I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." This is such an important sentence because it validates much of what we've been talking about. Every life circumstance comes with its challenges that have to be faced. Poverty has its problems, and affluence has its problems. And contentment is something we need to learn whether we're in times of plenty or in times of want. And then he says he has specifically learned the secret to facing these different circumstances. And what's that secret? He writes, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." I think a better translation of this is actually, I can do all this through him who strengthens me. You might find that in your NIV. Now, this is a coffee mug verse. We love it. We got like t-shirts with it. You're sitting at work. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But that translation, I can do all this through him who strengthens me, is helpful because it helps us understand what the all things that Christ helps us with is in reference to. What's it in reference to? Being content in every situation. Paul's basically saying here, I can be content in all situations through him who strengthens me. Clarification here. Paul's not saying that when he's in a hard time that he simply asks Jesus to help and voila, he's content. It's not what this is saying. In fact, the Greek word we translate as learned is in the aorist indicative mood, which in this instance, it conveys the idea of things that are learned over time, a process. So whether he was in prison or living in wealth or shipwrecked or spending time with people he loved or fleeing a riot, Paul intentionally looked to Jesus for help, and over time, he developed the ability to be content regardless of his circumstances. He says, I can do all this through him who strengthens me. Now, we have to ask the question too, what does it mean for Jesus to strengthen us? This is one of those kind of intangible ideas that we often run into in Scripture. There is this reality that in our weakness, Jesus offers us a sense of emotional strength that sometimes we can't explain other than to say, Jesus gave me strength. But I think there's a more tangible way to think about this as well. I don't always eat as often as I should. And when I go too long, I get grumpy and tired and hangry, and I lack the motivation to do the things I need to do. And I have to eat something to regain the strength I need to continue on my day. Jesus' presence does for us what food does for our bodies when we are hungry. It gives us strength to continue on in his ways. By intentionally creating connection points with Jesus through prayer, silence, worship, Christian community, intentional obedience, loving neighbor and enemy, we put ourselves in a position where Jesus strengthens our weary minds. But there's also a connection here to what we said earlier about each of us having a God-shaped hole in our lives. Part of the strengthening that Paul's talking about here is the reality that when we try to live connected to Jesus, we're actually giving ourselves what we truly desire. And in that, we find a different type of satisfaction that strengthens us and gives us contentment. All of this is what Paul's encompassing when he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Now, this is a great passage because it helps us see Jesus as the answer to our issues with more. But I do want to jump over also to 1 Timothy 6 because I think this is going to give us a better, more complete understanding of contentment for us today. This is 1 Timothy 6, starting in verse 6. Now, context here, Paul's warning his disciple Timothy against certain people who are claiming to be teachers of Jesus, but who don't exhibit a moral, ethical lifestyle that has the characteristics that Jesus wants. In fact, it seems like these people are only teaching Jesus because they think it will bring them financial gain from the church. So this is what Paul tells about these teachers and encourages him to walk a different path. He says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world. We cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we'll be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs.
Notice, there's not a single command in these verses. Instead, Paul's giving Timothy a framework, a set of truths through which he can view his circumstances. And this framework, I think, can be really helpful for us as we seek to deal with our hunger for more. First, Paul says this, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Like I said before, the context here is a warning about teachers who don't exhibit Christ-like characteristics, but are teaching Jesus to try and gain some financial prosperity from the church. Paul's encouragement to Timothy is this: it's of more gain to develop your character than to try and fulfill your carnal desires for wealth and objects. These false teachers, they're just trying to gain wealth. To Paul, that's not a true gain. Godliness, which is a term that refers to a reflection of God's nature in our character, godliness with contentment, that is godliness with an attitude that says, I don't need all my desires filled, that is true gain. Here's the principle to remember as we seek to break the hold of stuff over us. Ultimately, your character has a bigger impact on your satisfaction than stuff and wealth. The way you interact with others, the value that you place on relationships, the attitude that you have towards possessions, your honesty, the way you treat your job and your work-life balance, your character has a bigger impact on how fulfilled you are than does the accumulation of things. Then Paul says, "For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content." The word we translate as clothing in verse 8 just means anything that covers you, and probably could mean like clothes and housing. But the point's still clear. We don't really need that much to be satisfied. You didn't bring anything into the world. You're not going to take anything with you. You don't really need that much. Are you fed? Are you clothed? Do you have a place to live? Do you have Jesus? Do you have brothers and sisters in Christ? It doesn't really take much more. So here's the principle to remember when we're trying to learn contentment. You don't really need that much to be happy. Like we heard from Jesus earlier, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Now, this principle serves two purposes for us. First, it helps us do battle with our insatiable thirst for more. We get to remind ourselves constantly, I don't actually need that much to be happy. But it also convicts us when we find ourselves poring over websites online or trying to figure out exactly what we want to buy or even impulse buying in the store. This idea forces us to ask, do I really believe that I don't need that much to be happy? Or have I bought into the lie that life does exist in an abundance of possessions? Next, Paul says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." This is a warning. Paul's saying when we act on our desires to accumulate, we fall into a snare. We plunge ourselves into destruction. In fact, striving after gaining too much stuff can cause us to wander away from the faith. Basically, Paul's saying, be wary of the lies of money. If you're starting to think that you can be happy by your stuff, that's a lie. And if you give in, it can do you real pain. Hey, I've got to wrap this up because I've already said probably more than we can absorb in one sitting. So let me do the preacher thing and try to give you three takeaways to help you lean into Jesus and strengthen your contentment. First, there is no way you can create contentment without trying to have a vibrant relationship with Jesus.
The key to contentment is not simplicity, it's not asceticism, it is cultivating a life with Jesus, where through spending time with him, you learn to love what he loves, and through building a deep connection with him, you come to be satisfied in the type of life that he encourages, and through worship and prayer, his presence becomes something that makes you feel more joy than buying a new pair of boots. But there is a degree to which knowing the ways of Jesus are true and understanding them for yourself, that they're good, those two things are different. We can know that the ways of Jesus are true, but unless we're willing to do them, we don't understand that they're true for us. Which is why I think it's a wise thing for most Christians to try and cultivate a lifestyle where we live with less. Now, I'm not a bright beacon of this. I like things a lot. But when Jesus says stuff like, life doesn't consist in an abundance of possessions, it can be hard to experience this truth for ourselves while at the same time embracing a lifestyle of abundance. Not saying that you can't do that. Not saying that Christians must embrace a lifestyle of less. But there is a reason that Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Sometimes we need to ask ourselves, do I just think this is true theoretically? Or is this actually something that I understand by the way that I live? It might be a good idea for us to try and live with less. Finally, this is huge for us. Limit your exposure to the world's attempts at stoking the flames of desire in your life. Browsing Amazon or your favorite brand's websites or scrolling Instagram and Facebook past all of those ads and influencers, it's probably not doing anything for you to learn contentment. And honestly, it's probably not doing much to help your spiritual formation either. It might actually be doing some spiritual deformation. In his book, The Common Rule, Justin Early talks about setting limits on our internet use. And one of the limits that he finds helpful for his soul is he doesn't go online unless there's an actual reason and purpose for him to go online. He's not just going to scroll or to look at stuff or to be distracted, because doing that exposes him to all sorts of influences that actually aren't helpful. Now, you don't have to do what he does, but you do have to find for yourself some way of limiting the impact of advertising in the algorithms of desire. Maybe it's time that you start to ask yourself, how do I limit the impact of ads on my soul? Let me sum up. When we feed our insatiable thirst for more, it can wreck our emotional health. However, the answer to more is not just less. The answer to more is Jesus. So we try and help him teach us contentment by creating a vibrant relationship with God, by learning that we don't really need that much to be happy, which could include practicing living with less. And then we find ways to reject the lies that more makes us happy by limiting our exposure to advertising and the lies of this world. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word to us. In a lot of ways, God, this is something that is hard for us as modern Americans because it's asking us to reject the water that we swim in. So I pray that you give us wisdom on how to develop contentment. Teach us that we don't really need that much to be happy. Help us to find satisfaction in you. Lord, we ask all this in your name. Amen.